From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Kevin Beasley. This week, the change of leadership in North Korea, treating the injured from the fighting in Syria, and singing happy songs in a sad city. After a week of public mourning, the people of North Korea staged a dramatic goodbye for their late leader, Kim Jong-il. Leading the ceremonies at his state funeral was Kim's third son and successor, Kim Jong-un. North Korean media portrayed the young Kim, he's in his late 20s, as being in full control of the impoverished but nuclear-armed country. NPR's Anthony Kuhn sent this report from Seoul in South Korea.
Flanked by army jeeps, heir apparent Kim Jong-un walked at the head of a black limousine bearing his father's casket. Another limousine followed, carrying a giant portrait of Kim Jong-il smiling in his trademark khaki jumpsuit. The cortege went on, rolling through the snow-covered streets of Pyongyang, which were lined with weeping, chest-beating soldiers and civilians. The displays of emotion sometimes appear genuine, sometimes just ritualistic and histrionic. The dear leader worked only for the people's happiness, a state television announcer lamented, and now those people are bursting into tears at the sight of his body being taken to his father's mausoleum. Since Kim's death on December 17th, his son has quickly moved to the top of the ruling party, the state, and the military. But analysts believe the real power behind the young Kim is his uncle and mentor, Jang Song-taek. Chung-min Lee, dean of the Graduate School of International Studies at Seoul's Yonsei University, explains.
Jang Song-taek is the most senior member of the Kim family, and as a result, he has a critical role to play. Whether he will be able to rule behind the throne, as it were, nobody really knows. But the key message here is the army and the party and the Kim family are one.
The succession appears to be going smoothly for now, but in the nearly 3 years since Kim Jong-il suffered a stroke, his son's grooming has suffered some setbacks. Two armed attacks on South Korea and a domestic currency reform were all supposed to build up the young Kim's resume. But Choi Jin-uk, a North Korea expert at the Korean Institute of National Unification in Seoul, says they all turned out to be costly blunders.
They have nothing to show to give credit to Kim Jong-un, so that's why North Korea is trying to find legitimacy based on his family background.
Experts say North Korean elites generally buy into the Kim royal bloodline and a militarized, nuclear-armed state as sources of legitimacy. North Korea expert Brian Myers of Dongseo University in Busan says that North Korea can't pin its hopes for legitimacy on economic performance because its neighbors to the south are doing it so much better.
I can't see who inside the elite would have an interest in converting North Korea from a military-first state, from a very successful far-right state, into a kind of poor man's version of South Korea.
Per capita incomes in South Korea are at least 13 times higher than those in the North, and were the North to open up, experts predict its government could not meet expectations of higher living standards. This is why, says Yonsei's Chung-min Lee, North Korea only works as a closed system, and its generals are not wrong in fearing that they could lose power if they try the same market reforms as China and Vietnam.
As long as they maintain that closed system, that regime will survive. But the moment they begin to pry open their doors, the moment that technology and capital and other types of news comes in, that is the beginning of the end of the Kim dynasty.
But the problem with hereditary dynasties, of course, is that each ruler tends to have less power than the previous generation, and justifying the regime's existence just gets harder and harder. Anthony Kuhn, NPR News, Seoul.
Coming up, treating the injured from the fighting in Syria and singing happy songs in a sad city. As the violence continues in Syria, doctors are risking their lives to help the wounded. Too scared to get treatment in official hospitals, the injured are being helped by an underground network of medical staff. They're supported by smugglers in neighboring Lebanon, who get medical supplies into Syria and take the most seriously wounded out. NPR's Deborah Amos reports.
This sparsely furnished apartment in northern Lebanon is the first stop on the medical smuggling route.
This is the warehouse. It's in a bedroom. That's stethoscopes. These are bandages.
Aminoplasma.
Bottles of plasma.
A young Syrian named Mohammed has been running this underground supply line since May. It's a lifeline for the Syrian city of Homs, just 30 miles away. Surrounded by the army under heavy shelling, the wounded are too afraid to go to the state hospitals.
We still need many things that we are not able to secure. X-rays, surgical equipment for bones, surgeries, anesthesia.
Are you saving lives, do you think?
It's an attempt to save lives. Some we are able to save, others we are not.
Mohammed makes arrangements with a trusted crew of smugglers. The boxes are broken down into smaller packages for the hazardous journey, in trucks, motorcycles, even donkeys, on border crossings that are heavily mined and patrolled.
Which road, where he will drop it, what they need, what is the shortage, what they need to send from here.
And do you do that every day?
Every day.
This everyday traffic goes both ways. The makeshift clinics inside Syria can only do so much, stop the bleeding and some of the pain. The more seriously wounded, often with multiple gunshot wounds, are smuggled into Lebanon.
This is one office of the underground clinics on the border between Lebanon and Syria. We can't say where we are. We can't even tell you the doctor's name. He says his wife doesn't even know that he's doing this, but when there are wounded on the Syrian side, he gets the first call.
This Lebanese doctor says it's his duty to help.
I go to the border, I meet with the wounded person, I conduct basic first aid.
Treatment is often in the back of his car until he can drive to his clinic for more intensive care. In this Lebanese farming community, families open their homes to Syrians who need long-term recovery.
These are Syrians here?
A spare room serves as a hospital room for 30-year-old Rabih al-Zain. His shattered leg is wrapped in bandages. Syrian security police opened fire on demonstrations, he says, in his village near Homs. When he tried to help the wounded, he was shot repeatedly in the leg. In a nearby farmhouse, a 19-year-old Syrian army deserter props himself up on a pillow when visitors arrive. He stepped on a mine on the border a few weeks ago and lost his leg below the knee. I never got the chance to fight. I didn't have any weapons, he says. The state hospital in his Syrian village has been turned into a military barracks, he says, adding, they would have killed me if I'd gone there for help. His mother weeps when she hears him talk about the explosion that severed his leg. She crossed the border as soon as she heard he was in Lebanon. I'm afraid, she says softly. I have 9 children. We're under a lot of pressure. I still have family inside. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Beirut.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Kevin Beasley. The caroling season in Greece runs through the Orthodox Christian holiday known as Epiphany, which is celebrated on January 6th. Children go door to door singing songs of the season, hoping to raise money to buy presents. But this year, austerity has dampened everyone's spirits. Joanna Kakisis sent this postcard from Athens.
3 11-year-old girls are jangling triangles and caroling outside a worn-out apartment building in their neighborhood. The song is called Kalinesperan Arjondes. It's a joyous greeting for those who open their homes to holiday cheer. But there's not much cheer in Athens this year. The girls are singing outside because no one in this building will let them in. Some people let us in with love and others just don't answer the door, says Alexandra Borozon, one of the girls. Are you scared to go inside, I ask? Our dads are watching over there, says another girl, Stella Tsera. She points to two burly men standing just a few steps away. One is Vangelis Pisias, a 56-year-old architect. We're scared because crime has gone up here and we have to be careful, he says. The people inside are scared too. Some also don't feel like hearing carols. And they definitely don't have the money to spare. Yolanda Muzakiti is 9 years old and she also sees that people are giving less this year. Trailed by her mother, she's caroling to Urania Godeva, who works in a craft shop in Yolanda's apartment building. Urania opens the cash register and gives the girl 2 euros.
It's true, people aren't giving as much money this year, but caroling is a tradition. If shopkeepers run out of money, I've seen them give children other stuff, like an orange soda or chocolates.
Irini and Panayotika Budi like the chocolates, but they really need the money. Their mother, Poppy, lost her job as a maid a few months ago. There's a crisis even in caroling, Poppy says. People can't give much. And we've only gone to shops because people won't let us into their homes. Irini and Panayoti make about 40 euros from their day of caroling. Before the long bus trip home, they stop for cotton candy near a sad-looking Santa ringing a bell. It's a cloudy day and people are somber. And then, near an empty shopping center, they hear this. It's a traditional carol from northeastern Greece, sung by 6 young people from a theater troupe. One of them is playing the gaida. It's like a bagpipe, and people are clapping and dancing. No one has shopping bags, but everyone is singing. Panayoti and Irini run to join the dance, and the crowd grows bigger and bigger. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Kevin Beasley.